So next week, Kevin will be talking about Esther, and this week is going to be a little bit different, but I'm excited. So we're going to start with a question this morning. So name this movie quote. Okay, name this movie quote. Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. Ask your neighbor, what's this movie from? It's not Top Gun. This is from The Wizard of Oz, that's what I'm told. I haven't seen The Wizard of Oz. I'm not alone. I have not seen, I know, I don't have my picture in the directory, and I've never seen The Wizard of Oz. Let's close in prayer. We're done this morning. I've never seen it, but I did have a friend when I visited, when I was a kid. I went to his house. He had a Wizard of Oz poster on the wall. And you know this line, because it's a famous line. And I watched the two-minute clip, which made absolutely no sense to me with the munchkins and the... It made no sense, but I just wanted to make sure. This was Wizard of Oz, right? I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. Look, if you're new to Quest, we welcome you wherever you're at on your movie knowledge. I am regularly made fun, like I mentioned, Top Gun, still haven't seen that. I mean, you guys always make fun of me for my lack of knowledge, which is great. So we're really, if you've never seen this, you're in a great place. So I'm not in Kansas anymore. It's a big phrase, partly because I think it rings true, but it applies to all sorts of experiences where you end up in some new place or a different place, and you realize, I'm not where I used to be. This is different. This certainly isn't Kansas. Unless you're watching online from Kansas this morning, you are in Kansas. It really, I think, fits our series. So Life in Babylon is all about how we navigate the question of following Jesus in a post-Christian culture. This isn't Kansas anymore. This is a new day and age where we have to navigate questions of faith and what we believe and how we express faith and live it out in a different context, not in Kansas anymore, life in Babylon. So we're taking this month to look at a unique season in the history of the people of Israel in Babylon, or around these events, around the year 600 to 538, 39 BCE, so 600 years before Jesus in Babylon, you have the Israelites who lived, and Babylon became the reigning superpower, and they invaded into Palestine, and there is all this conflict, and they had all the firepower and all the power, and they, with successive waves of deportations, took key people from Jerusalem, from the lands, and took them to Babylon, and they established their regime. And the people of God had asked the question, how do I live in Babylon? How do I navigate these tensions? There's different language, there's different religious values, there's different everything, and we feel this pressure of how do we live our faith? And that's the question for our series, how we navigate living in a post-Christian culture that's going through profound and radical change, and how do we live in Babylon? And we've had this spectrum up each week, where on the one side, there's this tension when you live in Babylon to buy into the culture, to want to, on the one side, just sit, kind of blend in, be a chameleon, and just kind of, whether either buying in full force or just kind of silently, just you can get moved into this position where you end up kind of buying in, either because it's not popular, you're not sure what you believe, and there's just all these pressures, and it's easy to do that. And maybe on the other end of the spectrum is to become hyperly, well, I should be on this side, being totally separatist, being afraid, which it's understandable to feel afraid or whatever the motive, but to be on the side of wanting to pull back, wanting to isolate, to withdraw, and to circle up with just kind of the religious circle. And in a sense, you can end up becoming hyper-religious and just saying, I'm going to pull into this circle and do that. In both of these extremes, if you buy in, you've compromised on, I think, key things about what Jesus has said. And if you totally withdraw, you've also compromised on the mission that Jesus gave us to be in the world, and but not of it, and to be for it. And to be living in this tension, in this middle, is hard. But that's our series. That's what we've been focusing on. And there's different characters we looked at who lived at different seasons through this Babylon, some early, some in the middle, some from Jerusalem, some from Babylon, and then the end of it. So the first week was Daniel, which was a key figure, and we're going to go back to him a little bit this morning. And he showed us the power of integrity, of being a whole person with his faith and living it out and not compromising. It was Daniel. He lived in the middle with integrity. And Jeremiah lived with hope, incredible hope, with an incredibly bleak life. He went through incredible challenges and suffering, but he had hope. There was a God who could meet him where he was at and their whole nation where they were at and bring rescue and redemption. And he had hope and he didn't see it. He died through this exile. He didn't make it through, but he had hope. And last week we saw Nehemiah on the end of the exile when Persia came in. They were the new superpower and they sent people back in a move of grace. Nehemiah went back to rebuild, and he had incredible wisdom to navigate those questions. And today, real quick, we have our timeline. It's this unique sliver of just about 100 years or so, where you're living in this tension with all these questions that apply today. And we've looked at all these figures, and today we're going to look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Or as Kevin said the other day, my shack, your shack, or a bungalow. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they're famous guys. Oh, where do they show up? Let's look. In Daniel chapter 1, we'll have it on the screen. This sets the stage and introduces us to them. So we read, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand and with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. He takes all the important treasures, and in a move of power and control, he takes them to his land. And then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. That's another word for the Babylonians. And the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank, and they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. And among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These are the Babylonian names. We'll put them in the middle. I don't know if you've really felt this, but what an incredible, challenging experience to be taken to a new land and to be given a new name. There's new religious values, new cultural values, new language. You don't speak the language. And they say, you have a new name now. You're no longer Hananiah, you're no longer Mishael, you're no longer Azariah, you're Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. You have a new name, and you need to live that out, or you'll pay the price. Because, they were taken to Babylon in the east, modern-day Iraq, Iran. They were taken there, and the city of Jerusalem is under siege. Their people are being killed. The city is leveled. The gates burned, and they are taken and forced to buy in. They face incredible challenge. I mean, can you imagine me giving a new name and saying, you're no longer this, you are this? I mean, that's not being taken to California and first forced to try In-N-Out Burger. This isn't that. This is dark, this is challenging, this is scared for your life territory. And Daniel's there, and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, given a new identity, saying, you live this out. So you have their Babylonian names and their Hebrew names. They also have some vegetarian names you might be familiar with. If you know VeggieTales, you know they're also known as Rakshak and Benny, which is kind of shorthand. So if I call them that, it's all in good. I love this. I grew up watching this a ton, VeggieTales. It's a classic story where Rakshak and Benny are forced to work for Nezer, not Nebuchadnezzar, just Nezer. So if I call Nebuchadnezzar, you'll know what I'm saying. They were forced to work in a chocolate factory. So it's a little different than Babylon, okay? But it's for kids to tell the story where Nezer makes all these chocolate bunnies and he sings the bunny song, you know? The bunny, the bunny. Okay, so he does that, and then he sets up a giant statue of a bunny and says, you'll worship the bunny and sing the bunny song. And they say no, and they, well, I don't want to spoil the story. But VeggieTales, Rack Shack, and Benny, it's a really powerful story. It is, I think, profound for us. It's profound for children. And it's this question of how do you live in Babylon? How do you live this out? How do Rack Shack and Benny do it? They live it out with courage. That's our word this morning, courage. You had Daniel's integrity, Jeremiah hope, Nehemiah wisdom, and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego is courage. Courage is strength in the face of challenge. It is endurance through pain. It is confidence in your mission, and it is assurance of hope. You know it's worth it. Whatever the cost, you have assurance and confidence to live it out. They live by courage. So our three heroes, they show up next in Daniel chapter 2. And just to set the stage, a couple weeks ago we looked at this story in Daniel 2 where King Nebuchadnezzar says he has this disturbing dream, and he calls all of his magicians together and he says, hey, I want you to interpret the dream. But I don't want you to just interpret the dream. I want you to show real spiritual power. So tell me the dream first and then interpret it. And everyone says, you can't, what? You can't do that. Or you're all going to die. I go, oh. So Daniel's there. He's in that mix. And he's in the mix, all the challenge there. And we saw him live that out. We read in Daniel chapter 2, verse 17, that Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, their Hebrew names, his companions, his friends. And he told them to seek the mercy from the God of heaven concerning the mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. These three are his friends. They are his prayer warriors. They are with him. They are who he goes to when he has a bad day, a scary day. You live in Babylon. You have courage because of community. He has these people who are, he goes by in this chapter, they're Hebrew names. He knows that they're not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He knows that they're Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He knows who they really are as followers of God. He knows that. And he goes to them, and they walk with him through it, and they join him in prayer. And if you remember in the story, Daniel, he is given the vision, and he goes to Nebuchadnezzar and says, hey, here's the vision. And it's that there's going to be a lot of kingdoms after you, and then eventually God's going to set up his own kingdom. So you have your power, but it's not going to last. And then we read in chapter 2, verse 46, that Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel. And he commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. And the king answered and said to Daniel, truly, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries. For you have been able to reveal this mystery. And then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. Daniel gets promoted to essentially the highest inner circle, and Nebuchadnezzar, his enemy, the foreign power that came and occupied and deported him, he ends up in the inner circle. And God honored him and put him in this position of influence, and he looks out for his buddies, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and gets them promoted into essentially being political rulers in Babylon, where they're seeking the flourishing of this community that they're opposed to. They're there living it out. What a position. What a position. So they're probably in a separate kind of circle than Daniel, which is why Daniel doesn't show up in this next scene that they're most famous for in chapter 3, which is where we're going to spend most of our time. We read in Daniel chapter 3 that despite Daniel's challenges to Nebuchadnezzar, he's not listening, so I call him Nezer. Maybe he is, I don't know. Nebuchadnezzar, he says, yeah, I know there's more kingdoms that'll come after me, but I'm still going to do everything in my power to set up my kingdom. So we read in Daniel chapter 3, he's committed to his own project of glory. That in verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar then made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and breadth was 6 cubits, that is 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. He set it up, this image, in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, that is, governors of a satrapy. It's a province. You know, like, that's a weird word. A satrap. It's a ruler of a satrapy. And then the prefects, so Percy Weasley and his crew, okay? And then you have the governors and the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of all the provinces, and they come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, treasurers, justices, magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast out into the fire, into a burning fiery furnace." And therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This last verse literally reads, as soon as they were hearing it, they were falling down. So did you see it? Did you see something show up 6 times in these verses? Ask your neighbor, did somebody set something up? Yes. 6 times it says Nebuchadnezzar set up an image, a golden image, and Nebuchadnezzar set it up. He set it up. He set it up. He set it up. He set it up. It's all about him. This is an image that he is. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it is of. It could be a statue of him. It could be a giant bunny statue. Probably not. Probably not. Probably an obelisk, a kind of square tower, kind of like the monument, Washington Monument, with a little pyramid at the top, but we're not totally sure. We don't know, and it doesn't really matter. Actually, that's not the concern. What's on the image doesn't matter. It's what it, who set it up and why. And this is Nebuchadnezzar. It stands for himself. It stands for his power. It stands for him saying, "This is my kingdom. You will gather around what I say, worship what I say, do what I say, and it's going to be in the plain. It's not going to be in the city center. It's going to be out in the plain where we can gather all the people, and you will see this is the most important thing. It will stand 90 feet tall. You'll see it as you come out. This is the gathering point. I will be the one who gathers and rules. I'm the one in charge." This is total contrast to Daniel chapter 2 when Daniel told him, "Hey, there's going to be kingdoms that coming after you." And he says, "Over my dead body, I'm going to set up worship. I'm going to rule. This is me. I am not giving up." This is his pride to say, "I'm going to be the unifying center, and I'm going to get all the important political people. We're going to play all this music, and they will worship. They will do what I say when I say it, or they will die. They will conform, or," he says, "or you'll be cooked. You're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace." And so that's the plot that's set. And then we read in verse 8, "Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans, Babylonians, they came forward, and they maliciously accused the Jews." And this is, it literally reads, it's a figurative expression that literally, it says, they ate the flesh torn off of their body. They ate the flesh that was torn off from the Jews. They were voraciously after them. So an expression to say they're accusing them, they're going after. They hate them. And maybe it's jealousy. Maybe they want that position that they're at. Maybe they just hate that there is a foreigner who is in this position, or they know the Jewish people worship a different God, and they hate that. We don't know exactly their motive, but they know that they are opposed. They're against them. And this is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We'll find out in a moment. So these certain guys and gals, they come forward, accuse them, and they declare in verse 9 to Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever." A little flattery, butter him up. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, that they shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. Obviously, we've heard the decree. We understand exactly what you've said, Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men, O king, pay no attention to you, and they do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you set up. Do you see they made it personal? You put them in charge here, didn't? Wasn't that you? And they're not paying attention to you, and they're not serving your gods and the golden image that you set up? Nebuchadnezzar, they're against you. They personalize it. And, you know, like, how ungrateful. King, you put them in these spots, and here they are just defying you, that they didn't bow down and do what you said when you brought out the band. Like, we need to, Nebuchadnezzar, you know what to do. So then we read in verse 13 that Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. And so they brought these men before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made. Well and good. If you're ready, you can do this. All good. All good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? In other words, you have one last chance, guys. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, I've given you all this power position. You got it? You got one chance, okay? Or be thrown into the fire. Who's stronger than me? I decide your fate. Do you realize who you're talking to? In this whole picture you get, this is, one commentator says, this is human pride led to its, taken to its logical conclusion. This is, I think, something that deep down actually probably runs in the heart of every human being, where we really can say, this world is about me and my, who I am and my power, my control, I'm going to make it about me. And he just has the power and position to do that, live that out. And he says, there's no other gods but me. Who can rescue you out of this? Like, I'm the one who holds your life. Then we read in verse 16, this incredible response. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We don't need to respond. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, even if he doesn't, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods and worship the golden image that you set up. This is a climactic moment. I say, we don't have to answer you. We don't. They're talking to the king. we don't have to answer and respond to you and what you have said. We don't need to go change our answer on the test. Like, you know what we did. We stand by it. And we don't need to explain ourselves. We have the courage to answer you here and now. Yes, we know there's a cost. Yeah, we know there's a cost. But this is we're not doing it. You don't need to bring out the band and John Williams and do the whole thing again. You don't need to do that. Or you know our answer. Like, how courageous to be strong in the face of fear, to be in the face of challenge, and to know the consequences, and to know, though, the mission, and to know the confidence in who they have trusted, and they say, we're not answering you, Nebuchadnezzar. It's incredibly courageous. But it's outrageous to him. So, if you imagine his face, what incredible outrage he would have. Then we read in verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, which maybe literally 7 times as much, or maybe it's his way of saying, hey, make it as hot as possible. 7's kind of a number of completeness, so make it as incredibly hot as possible, which I'm pretty sure is what the weatherman said about the forecast for the weather this past week. They heated up 7 times. He orders then, and we read in verse 20, that he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And then these men were bound, and their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and other garments, as much kindling as possible. And they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace was overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, true, O king." And he answered and said, "But I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." VeggieTales, he says, is the fourth one kind of shiny. And the irony here is profound. He orders this act of execution, and he can't protect his own servants from the fire. But the servants of this other king are totally fine. They're totally fine walking around, unbound, and there's a fourth. He says there's a fourth, like a son of the gods. He looks human, but he looks heavenly, kind of shiny, something godlike. And it's this fascinating element of the story that we don't really get much detail. Nebuchadnezzar, in the next verse, is going to say he thinks it's an angel, which very well might be. Others think this might be the pre-incarnate Christ, that this might be Jesus. I don't think we really know. I don't think we get enough details. It's kind of mysterious. We don't know, but that actually, where God is going to be present with them, whether it's the pre-incarnate Jesus, whether it's an angel, or even if not, even if there wasn't a fourth, he would be present with them there in the fire. But in a unique way, God was present with them. And we don't know the details. I want more, but we just don't know. But they experience literally this promise from Isaiah chapter 43, verse 2. It says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." They experience that. Then we read in verse 26 that then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God." Oh, their God is real. "Come out and come here." And then Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, governors, the king's counselors, they gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over their bodies and those men. And the hair of their heads was not singed, and their cloaks were not harmed, and there's no smell of fire that had come upon them. You know the smell of fire? Yeah, in my high school chemistry class, someone burned some hair on a Bunsen burner, and it smelled. There's none of that. And 28, Nebuchadnezzar answered, and he said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command. They disobeyed me, but blessed be them. Blessed be them. They disobeyed and they yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God." They actually had integrity, and I respect that. "Therefore, I make a new decree. Any people, nation, language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. They get job promotions for standing up to the king, and God honors their courage, their strength in the face of danger and fear. And Nebuchadnezzar recognizes the power of their God, and that even though they defied his decree and deserved death, that they should be given respect and honor. And he moves from murderous anger to reverence and awe. And this happened as a witness to them because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were courageous. They were strong. They didn't compromise. And one commentator says they had Babylonian names but not Babylonian hearts. They knew who they were as followers of God, and this was a line that they would not cross. They would work in this foreign government. They would work for the flourishing of this community, but there was a line that they wouldn't cross, and they said, sorry, we can't do that. They lived in between. They didn't buy into the culture, but they also weren't separatist. They worked in this unique time and place for the good of these people, and they didn't pull back. They leaned in, and they were engaged, and they were public figures, but yet they didn't compromise. They lived in the middle with courage. And they joined Daniel, I think, in this attribute of integrity. They had courage, strength in the face of challenge, endurance through pain, confidence in their mission, and assurance of hope. Whether we die or not, we're not doing it. We know who God is, and we know it's worth it, no matter the consequences. So a couple principles, I think, stand out as we look at this powerful story and this example. A couple principles. First, that courage is cultivated in community. I think they were stronger because they were together. Just like Daniel said, hey, come pray with me. I need help. They were there. They were there then, and they were there with each other. And you need brothers and sisters with you through life, through navigating the tensions in a post-Christian culture. You're going to need people that can walk with you through the questions you have, the tensions you have. Having people in your corner is not a luxury. It's a necessity for survival. And you talk to Christians in other parts of the globe where there's not a church there's a bunch of churches on the street, right? You go to other places, and this is lifeblood, to be connected to the tribe, to be with other followers of Jesus. This is not an option. So are you in community? Do you have people in your corner that you can share these questions, the tensions, the struggles you have? Maybe it's in your job where you're a Christian and it's a challenging world to navigate. How do I express my faith or not? What can I say or not? Those are challenging questions. And to be honest, for me, my Monday morning looks very different than all of yours, because I work at church. And you live with these tensions in profound ways. And surviving in Babylon, you need people. Maybe you need someone who's in your career field or someone who's lived in that world more, and they know those tensions. They can help you navigate those questions. Maybe it's that. Or maybe it's just, man, life is discouraging, and people around you are just discouraging. You need people to lift you up and pray with you. You need community. There's strength in being together. So courage cultivating community. Secondly, we see courage exists in the face of challenge by definition. Okay. It's not just, yay, let's be courageous now and leave. And this is going to be blood, sweat, and tears. Courage by definition exists in the face of challenge. It's going to be difficult. And in the face of compromise, these three men really challenge us to say, don't compromise. There's going to be lines. Don't cross those lines. Don't give up your discipleship to Jesus because of the pressures. Maybe it's social pressures. Maybe it's job pressures. Maybe it's for money or power or safety or a relationship. There's going to be a faith that don't give in just in the face of conflict. It doesn't mean go look for every fight you can and fight it as mean and harsh as possible. Not at all. Not at all. There's wisdom to this, right? Remember last week? This doesn't cancel out wisdom from Nehemiah. Wisdom. But to recognize, okay, there's going to be these tensions, and I have to have convictions as a follower of Jesus. If I really believe who he is and what he's and his claims, it shapes all of life. And to then have integrity to live that out, just like Daniel, to be whole people, to know what we believe and why, and to know the God that we trust. Jesus says in Matthew 16, he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Take up your cross. This path of daily dying to self, of execution, where he ultimately goes. And for whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his soul? And what shall a man give in return for his soul? Jesus' words are this challenge to say, don't forfeit. Don't compromise. Don't give in. Don't give up who you are. Remember your Hebrew name. Remember that you're Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. It will be costly and there will be sacrifice, but there's true life down that road. And I think lastly, I want to focus here, and we'll land here to end, is that this idea of courage comes, the source for it, it comes from confidence in who God is. Ultimately, this isn't about willpower or wishful thinking. Courage results from confidence in who he is. This is being deeply connected to him and knowing whether I die or whether I live, I am the Lord's. To know he will vindicate me, and it maybe won't be in this life. It maybe won't. For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that's what they said. And they lived through. God showed up miraculously and delivered them. But we know countless examples of that doesn't happen. And people pay the ultimate price. But maybe the vindication isn't in this life, but it's the life to come. So this week, one person in particular has come to mind who kind of exhibited that kind of courage that I want to close with sharing his story. And his name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Maybe you're familiar with him. This is Dietrich. He's an incredible man. He was a German Lutheran pastor during World War II, and he stood in staunch opposition to the Nazis and Hitler, and he led an underground illegal seminary to train pastors and missionaries during World War II. And he was opposing Nazism and Hitler and the whole regime before rise to power, during, and he was in and out of Germany. He was a pastor in London for a couple years. He was in the States for a little bit. And eventually his seminary was shut down by the Gestapo. And in 1939, so this is kind of the height of World War II, he returned to the States, to the U.S., at an invitation to teach as a theologian, seminary prof. And he returned, and within 2 weeks he said, I can't do this. I can't leave my people that I've been shepherding for these years in Nazi Germany. I'm going back. And some people were pretty mad at him for that. He says, no, I can't. I'm not backing down. I need courage to live where God has placed me. I would be running away from God. So he goes back to Germany. And there's a lot of dynamics to the story and where it goes. It's fascinating. We just don't have the time this morning. But eventually he's arrested in 1943 in April. And he was in prison for a year and a half. And during that imprisonment, he was in jail. But he had incredible favor with these guards, and they would be his courier service. They'd pass letters for him to send to family. And then they would take him to other cells of inmates who were despairing. They said, hey, you can go care for them. We'll unlock the door and go over. He spent a year and a half in jail and caring for other people, for despairing people. But then after a year and a half, in April 1945, he's taken to Flossenbürg concentration camp, I don't know the exact details, but I think it might have been less than a day. It's not long, where he was executed at the age of 39. He was killed 2 weeks before the camp was liberated by Allied forces, which is then the week after that is when Hitler took his life. So this is the tail end, and we have this recorded from an English officer who was with him. He says this, and this in the concentration camp. Bonhoeffer always seemed to me to spread an atmosphere of happiness and joy over the least incident, and profound gratitude for the mere fact that he was alive. He was one of the very few persons I've ever met for whom God was real and always near. On Sunday, April 18th, 1945, Pastor Bonhoeffer conducted a little service of worship and spoke to us in a way that went to the heart of all of us. And he found just the right words to express the spirit of our imprisonment and the thoughts and the resolutions it had brought us. And he had hardly ended his last prayer when the door opened and two civilians entered. And they said, Prisoner Bonhoeffer, come with us. And that had only one meaning for all prisoners. the gallows. And we said goodbye to him, and he took me aside. This is the end. But for me, it is the beginning of life. And the next day he was hanged in Flossenbürg. And that text that he spoke from that last time was the passage in Isaiah 53 that says, by his stripes we are healed. By Jesus' execution of being whipped, we are healed. He had that incredible courage in God who said, whether I live or die, I am the Lord's. This is the end, but it's the beginning of life. It's the beginning of life. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they exemplified that same courage, holding to the same hope that their God would be with them through the fires, through the furnace, and to rescue them, whether in the moment or ultimately. And their death would mean the beginning of life. And that courage only comes from a confidence in God. And we worship a God who has came with us, came into our world, and experienced the fires too. Who, in the person of Jesus, he was maliciously accused by those who opposed him. He was unjustly executed by the Romans. And he went through the fires and went through death unto life. And he's walked through the fires, and he wants to walk with you and me through the fires, through whatever you're going through. He is the source of our courage. And with that, let's praise. Let's praise him and pray. Lord, our courage can only come from you, from a deep confidence and trust in who you are, that you will be with us every step. And this journey, no matter how good or bad it is. And so, Lord, we ask for your strength to live out our faith with courage, with trust in you. Help us to rely on your presence. And we give you our hearts this morning with grateful thanks that you are with us through the fires. We pray this in Jesus' name.